This is an oral history recording for the Heritage Education Commission, made on January 29, 1985. I am Catherine Murphy, interviewing Dr. Clarence Sock Glassrud, Professor Emeritus in English Literature from Morehead State University, on the subject of regional literature. Before turning to our subject, Sock, could you provide a thumbnail autobiographical sketch for us, where you were born and raised, educated, when you came to Morehead?
Well, I was born out on the prairie about 12 miles southwest of here in North Dakota, where my father had homesteaded in 1878. I grew up in Detroit Lakes from the age of 10 or 11 on, graduated from high school there, and taught a country school before I came to Morehead State Teachers College in the fall of 1930. During the Depression days up until World War II, I taught junior high and high schools in various Minnesota towns, Pelican Rapids, Lake City, and Mankato. After I came out of the Army, I had been doing graduate work at the University of Minnesota, but after the war, I went to Harvard and took an MA and PhD there, then came back to teach at Morehead State, first in 1947 for 3 years, and then after going back to finish my work, came back to teach in 1952 and retired in 1977.
Okay, well, that's a very pinpointed perspective. To begin, we're asked to cover a time period here from approximately 1930 to 1975. Mm-hmm. So perhaps you'd like to begin at the beginning of that span.
Sure.
And comment on the status of regional literature, either of or about this region or area.
Well, I tend to think about things in terms of the decades anyway, and 1930 was the year I just finished teaching a country school for a year and was just about to begin college work at Morehead State Teachers College in the fall after the Great Fire, when we were all crowded in the Weld Hall. Thinking back of the literary climate in this area then, my older sisters and I were great readers. We had all gone to country schools and read everything we could find. I can remember that in the 1920s we were especially fond of Hamlin Garland. He seemed our great hero because he was the one American writer of considerable status who wrote about the Middle West. And I don't think we read his best things, the early short stories that he published in the 1890s that his reputation rests on at the present time. But just before World War I, he had published a highly autobiographical thing called A Son of the Middle Border, which is a good work. It's it is essentially based on his father's story, and his own tells about how he abandoned the prairies where they'd homesteaded out in South Dakota, and he went to Boston and educated himself in the Boston Public Library. The main travel roads, of course, the collections of his stories published in those things like The Rose of Dutcher's Coulee. But the things that we were reading in the 1920s and early 30s were his reminiscences, beginning with his own autobiography, Son of the Middle Border, and then The Daughter of the Middle Border, which was the story of his wife's family, actually. She was a sister of Laredo Taft, the sculptor. And then he was publishing such books as Back Trailers of the Middle Border. There's one book after another, and we anxiously waited for each one because they were by Hamlin Garland. I don't think that Sinclair Lewis made that much of an impact on us. We, of course, very much aware of him, but he had sort of a bad reputation. He had besmirched the small towns of the our area, so we looked on him with some suspicion. And I don't think that we connected Scott Fitzgerald with our area at all, though he did, was born and grew up in St.
Paul,
but I don't think we knew that or we thought of him then. However, Ole Rolvag did make a very considerable impact. Giants in the Earth and His Exceeding Worth. He died in 31, you know. But his books affected us very, very deeply.
Mm-hmm. I suppose a sign of public recognition is when some of these things were introduced into a public school curriculum and taught as part of an English course. Were some of these writers picked up and taught in the public schools at an early time?
We were using Helman Garland. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. I don't think Rolvag, I suppose some of the schools must have been using Giants in the Earth, but curiously enough, I've gathered that it was more likely to be acquired in New York City high schools than they were out here. Mm-hmm. Still, I think it was in 1930, just the year before Rolvag's death, a fellow named Thomas Job, a Welshman who taught English at Carleton, had dramatized Giants in the Earth into not a very good play, but we did, Moorhead State Teachers College did put it on in the winter of 1930-31, and that had a considerable impact. However, I don't know that there were any Rolvag imitators or followers. I suppose you could say that Herbert Krauss, who went to St. Olaf and later on spent his whole career teaching at Augustana, wrote two novels, two pioneering novels, one called Wind Without Rain and the other The Thresher. Pretty realistic, and the setting is Krauss is German, and it's a German settlement south and of Fergus Falls in that area. They're pretty gloomy, and it's pretty heavy novels. Mm-hmm. But I suspect that was the kind of Rolvag influence. Wind Without Rain and The Threshers. He did write another novel, but on a historical subject.
Those are new titles to me, and that's an author I think I've not heard of.
He never was terribly popular. He's a nice fella, and I never met him. I should have made a point to go and see him, but his novels seemed to many of us pretty heavy going. Mm-hmm. They're authentic enough. But
were they published by a Midwestern press?
No, or? I think published by Bob's Merrill. Mm-hmm. No, they were published by a national press. Mm-hmm. There was another, I suppose, generally forgotten figure now, a woman named Martha Ostenso, or Ostenso, born in Bergen, Norway in 1900 and brought over by her parents in when she was 2 years old. Now, she ended up at the age of 15 in Canada and found her way into what's called the Brandon Collegiate School, a kind of teacher's college in Brandon, Manitoba, south and west of Winnipeg. But in 1925, she won a huge prize. It was $13,500, and that seemed an enormous sum of money at that time. It was offered by Dodds Mead, New York publisher, a well-known one of the top publishers at the time, and Pictorial Review magazine, which is like Ladies Home Journal and Woman's Home Companion and so on, and a Hollywood, I think it was a famous player, Lasky, the three of them together, raised $13,500. But she won the prize with a novel called Wild Geese, which was serialized in Pictorial Review and then published. Well, that was enormously popular. Now, the setting seemed to us, northwestern Minnesota. Actually, it was just over the border into Manitoba, but there's no essential difference, of course. Mm-hmm. And it's based on her own experience. It's very dark, and it's full of sort of elemental passions and the kind of realism, naturalism that was popular at that time. Mm-hmm. It made a very considerable impression around the country. It's a popular novel. Mm-hmm. The Canadians still reprint it and consider her an important person. She followed it up by a number of novels, about one a year. I can remember the second one was called The Mad Carews, and I remember reading it with not too much interest. finally, about 1943, I think it was, she published a book called Old River Remember. And the setting of that book is Moorhead, or a fictitious town called Wings, just out Wing or Wings, right outside of Moorhead. Now, the curious thing about this is somehow she got a hold of some of the Moorhead pioneering material and used it, because you read the novel, if you know anything about early history of this area, she had gotten access to this stuff and fictionalized it in the book. It's not too bad.
Was it, you know, as early as the coming of the railroad, or did it reflect
the
early development?
Very early days, the very, very first settlers.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the very first settlers, and there's steamboats and, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. Yes, the very earliest settlers, and her main characters, of course, are Norwegians. And, mm-hmm.
Did she succeed in getting any other novels serialized? That was a popular way of breaking into print.
Yeah, I'm not sure how the rest of them. I suppose they were serialized, but she mm-hmm. was reasonably successful writer mm-hmm. for some years, mm-hmm. though I don't think anything quite came up to her initial success with The Wild Geese, which made a very considerable mm-hmm. impact. Mm-hmm. And as I say, is still being republished by the Canadians, mm-hmm. so it is available. The other things I think can possibly be found in secondhand bookstores, but she's worth looking into. And I'd hope that sometime someone would republish the one mm-hmm. that's called Old River Remember, which for its interest for this particular area.
Mm-hmm.
I've been trying to find some clues as some other name that I remember. I think. The young woman's name was Elsie Rushfelt, and I believe she's in the Hawley area. And it seems to me that she had a short story, a realistic short story, accepted by some magazine and appeared, as I remember, in the best short stories of 1927 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been able to find out anything more about it. I've lost track of this.
Would she have been associated with Moorhead State,
the
normal school at that
here.
Time?
She might have come here as a student at one mm-hmm. time, but the thing that impressed us was that she was one of ours. She was a girl from our area, mm-hmm. and she had gotten several short stories mm-hmm. written about this area, which were properly picked up, but I'm the only person who remembers that, and I don't mm-hmm. remember enough. I'll have to do some more digging into it. At the mm-hmm. end of the 30s or early 40s, there was a professor at Moorhead State called Alan Woodall, who was interested in creative writing. He was a poet himself, and he got his own poetry published, he had it published at his own expense. I don't think that he had any following or had any great success, but he did have a sort of coterie at Moorhead about just before and just after 1930. Mm-hmm. And then I think he went out to teach in a California college later. But other than that, I don't remember any creative writing movements or any activity in that line. I should think maybe Leonard Sackett over at NDSU, who was interested in that sort of thing, might have done something, but I don't know of anything. Mm-hmm. The dramatic work done over there by Arvold was got a good deal of attention, but I can't remember any creative writing activity. I suspect that in the 1930s we were all so busy, staying alive mm-hmm. and finding we were just too close to things to worry. It seemed a sort of a frivolity, perhaps. And there wasn't much activity of that kind of thing until after World War II,
right.
as
and
far
the war
as I
years
know.
Probably
yeah.
usurped
right.
whatever creative energy
yeah, right.
Might have been abroad.
I don't think there was any, and there must have been some, but I can't remember any appreciable activity. I wasn't aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that made any... I guess at Moorhead State we published as a supplement to the school newspaper each spring a thing called Literary Designs, but it was pretty feeble stuff. They were just little feeble essays or and sketches.
Was it a student competition or
people? Yeah, yes. Awarded prizes and that sort of thing, but nobody paid very much attention to it, and nobody pretended the quality was very good, and I don't think any of the people involved took themselves very seriously. So, after World War II, of course, that's quite a different story, because then there has been a great flowering. There were, of course, people who were looking for a great novel about the Middle West and so on. I remember one that was hailed very hopefully was Wallace Stegner's The Big Rock Candy Mountain when it came out. It seems to me in 1943, a huge saga-type panoramic novel. And it was hailed as a great work, but I don't think it is. I think Stegner, who was born in this area, his mother was Norwegian, his father was a rolling stone who wandered, took his family from one town to another. They lived for a while, and I think he was actually born in Iowa, but they left there when he was a few weeks old, and I think they lived when he was a youngster in Grand Forks for a while, and they ended up finally out west, and the family lived in Salt Lake City, I think, when Stegner was going to high school.
Yeah, I think he's written more about the West.
Yeah, he does, the Rocky Mountain area. Mm-hmm. Now, he writes very, very well about the high plains and the mountains. But he does touch on this area, because he remembers his own family roots here. And when he discusses these things in his nonfiction, I think he's as good as anybody writing. His critical stuff is in, there's a book that's setting up in Canada, because they got up to Canada and homesteaded for a while just before World War I in an area, one of those areas which should not, where the land should never have been broken up because it was just too dry, absolutely hopeless. And he wrote a book called Wolf Willow, which is a very moving book. But it's a combination of memoirs. He said memoir and history and, I don't know what else he'd call it, fiction. He also wrote, published a collection of essays about the West in literature called The Sound of Mountain Water. Isn't that a great title?
Wonderful.
But it's a mixture of, some of the essays in it just are pins of praise to the mountains and the high plains, but some of them are literary things. I think he has a series of them. The West, the West Synthetic, Bret Hart, and the West Authentic, Willa Cather, and the West Emphatic or something, Bernard DeVoto. He was a friend of Bernard DeVoto's, I think. DeVoto, too, was from Salt Lake. But those are very, and some of the other things in that are, he explained why he was a hopeless square in his thinking, for instance, because his Western roots, he thinks. Those are very fine.
Yeah. Well, he has been a very successful and widely recognized American writer.
Right. He is a surprising. I always thought I still think that his nonfiction is much better than his fiction. I somehow or other, he's written a number of other novels, and I've never cottoned to them very much, but I admire his other writings very much. I was just trying to think, there was someone else that I forgot. There were Iowa writers like Ruth Succo, very realistic stuff. She published a highly successful book, a big one too, called The Folks. It made some considerable impression, seems to me, about 1933. But H.L. Mencken thought very highly of her. And there was a school of writers in Iowa that was making a considerable splash, but that was a little bit too far away for us. It didn't really have any impact here. Willa Cather, we did read, and We, of course, you're down in Nebraska, and that's a little far away, but we thought very highly of her, and we read her as her books came out.
It seems that many of the writers you've mentioned so far have dealt with the original experience with the land here, with a kind of opening up of the Middle West rather than... Sinclair Lewis dealt with small-town experiences more than with a relationship with...
I suppose it is the most dramatic theme to be found in the Middle West, is the taming of the land, the pioneering experience, and the homesteading experience. Mm-hmm. It is the great theme. Now, when Rolwog wrote two sequels to Giants in the Earth, as you know, Peter Victorious and then Their Father's God, but neither of them have the power of the Giants in the Earth at all, because they're involved with little bickerings between the various Lutheran sects, or the problem that Peter Victorious, the son of Barrett and Per Hansa, married an Irish Catholic girl, and it just led to difficulties. It was a Lutheran-Catholic split sort of thing. The themes, or the problem of whether to be completely Americanized or to try to hang on to your European roots. I remember that was an important consideration for Rolwog, who argued that you should not lose your European roots. But the Americanization, America First thing, or the antagonism toward what they call hyphenated Americans was very strong, especially in World War I era and just afterwards, which made it pretty difficult. Willa Cather argued that it was disastrous for people to lose their European roots, because American life would lose a great deal of rich heritage. Now, it was all right for her, because her own heritage was strictly WASP and Anglo-Saxon. She came from Virginia, but it was, I think, we're grateful that she recognized this sort of thing, that the Bohemian, German, Swedish pioneers in Nebraska had something to offer.
Right, because a lot of people from that early period were trying to
lose it and cover up
any trace of an accent and become a part of the American way.
Sure, as soon as they can get rid of their accent, you see, the better they were off. And as soon as they could be accepted as full-fledged Americans, they would do better for themselves. And that was tending course of the Germans, World War I. It was an absolute must, and they're just now recovering from that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on from, say, some immediate post-war writers, who are some more modern, contemporary people who are writing either of this region, either come from the region or are writing about it? There are some people... I know you've been interested in like Y. Woody, mm-hmm. who writes about this area and does have some roots here. J.F. Powers writes of Minnesota, at least, and I guess we consider that part of our territory.
Yeah, J.F. Powers is, of course, who has spent most of his life in Collegeville and in connection with St. John, sometimes teaching there as he is now. But he's an import, came here during World War II, doing alternate service, I think, in St. Paul Hospital and so on. He was a conscientious objector, much opposed to the war. But he married a St. Cloud girl and remained, Betty Wall, who was also a novelist and a fine one. And their children are all born there, though they're... Four of the five of them are living in Ireland now, because they spent some years over there taking advantage of the Irish generosity about creative writers, mm-hmm. not taxing them. I suppose Powers is easily the outstanding figure, and if we say we have a right to claim him, since he's been here since 1946. Mm-hmm. And his subject matter, when he writes, his settings are all invariably
usually Minnesota.
Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other thing, of course, is other curious thing is he generally writes about Catholic priests or but he is, I think, generally recognized as one of the finest writers living. It's just that his subject matter is, I suppose you could call it, narrow in scope. I'm still waiting for him to produce another novel. He's written only one novel, mm-hmm. you know.
Mort Durbin is the only novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that, there's still some question, I suppose, as to whether it's a novel, all right, but his real powers, real form is the short story, and the short story which are related, for mm-hmm. instance. The last stories that he has written, and there are four or five of them, which should form the nucleus of a new novel if he ever mm-hmm. finishes it, a story of how a young man comes to become a priest, what mm-hmm. factors lead him mm-hmm. to it, and what are his the problems he goes through. Mm-hmm. It seems to me they're more profound than the finest work he's ever done.
Mm-hmm. Some of his early short stories have been anthologized for years. What, Prince of Darkness?
The Valiant Woman, I think, mm-hmm. the one most commonly mm-hmm. Anthologized. What's the other one called? The Forks or something like that? It seems to me that's one of the common titles. But there are the two short story collections, one, The Prince of Darkness, and the other one, mm-hmm. What is it, The Presence of Grace?
I don't recall.
I think The Presence of Grace. And then in a little collection called Look How the Fish Live,
yes,
the last one,
yes.
which is kind of uneven. There's some superb things uh-huh. in it. And some other stuff that is not that good. But,
well, at his fascination with the church and clerical mm-hmm. subjects is very interesting. And I think his work shows tremendous love, but great criticism. Uh-huh. And he finds humor and of ironies that exist forever. He's very skillful in dealing
with this. I suppose irony is his... is his greatest tool. Mm-hmm. He is extremely funny, very subtly, but one of the most subtly funny writers I know of. He also is an extremely meticulous writer, and he never did write a great deal, but there is the care that he gives to his writings, and the finish that he writes to them, extremely delicate. And I think you'd have to be very narrow indeed to see that his choice of subject matter. The fact that he is most often writing about priests and their problems.
I remember one short story located near St. Cloud, which is the locale of many of his stories, in which a miracle has happened on a farmstead, and somebody's giving a message, and the message that's received, finally interpreted, is keep Minnesota green,
yes.
which
yes.
I think is a kind of typical.
Yes, I remember that one.
Revelation, or the kind of fun he has.
I know that I've come to know Jim Powers and Betty because I've stopped to see them several times on my way down to the cities, and I know that he dislikes teaching very much, and he finds it extremely hard to do any writing while he is teaching.
Is he trying to teach creative writing?
Yeah, he does.
And he finds it difficult.
And he's very hard on students. I found that out because mm-hmm. occasionally students have transferred from one college to another, mm-hmm. and I've talked to some of them who have come in contact with him, and he is very rough on students. He does not flatter them right, mm-hmm. at all. He comes down very hard on them. And he also finds it very painful. He says, I'm not an actor. I can teach. Why? I said, what? The kind of thing you're doing, which is a one-to-one thing with these people, is much harder than teaching in a classroom situation. But he didn't He didn't come to that early enough. And you know, from the beginning, he was offered. I remember 20 years ago, he did spend a part of a year at least at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and I think he had a standing offer at old colleges like Marquette and the University of Detroit, but he would usually not teach more than half a year at a time. But I don't know. There are those who say that after Vatican II, he sort of lost his subject matter. I don't know. I hope not. But he has been a long time. There are two short stories in the New Yorker that appeared about 5-7 years ago, and nothing since. But they were dealing with the same figures. What's a fellow named Joe or Bill or something like that, who became a young priest. And there are two stories dealing with the same character in that collection called Look How the Fish Live. Now, those four are dealing with, they're part of a whole. If he finishes that thing, seems to me those are the subtlest, the deepest things he's ever done, and I hope he does finish.
Well, he certainly met with great critical acclaim early on. Mort D'Urban won the National Book Award, I believe, in the year in which it was published.
Well, he still is. You do run into a reference, very respectable references to him as one of the finest of our writers. That's all I can say. I don't dare ask him, you know, how the book is coming.
Sure.
Betty Wall, Mrs. Powers, published a book called Rafferty, which is on an Irish. I think you read it.
Yes.
But Jim himself does not write about it. I think one or two stories in Look How the Fish Live connection, but he leaves that alone.
They did live in Ireland for some
for
time.
For 13, 14, 15 years.
Oh, that long.
Yeah, that long. Mm-hmm. That's why the children are still there.
Yes,
I asked, why
sure.
are they, what are they doing in Ireland? He said, I think they belong. They think they belong there.
Sure.
The eldest girl came back and is married and has a child that Jim Powers refers to as the nephew. Powers now is, I think, in his early 60s. But I hope in a long life. His father, the last I knew, was still living at the age of 98 or 99.
My goodness.
Illinois.
Really?
So. But I know that the Betty Powers has sent off another novel. I don't know what the subject is, but sent off another novel to a publisher. But I haven't heard since. She was over in Ireland visiting recently and just got back several months ago. There is another writer, you know, at St. John's now, John Hassler, that you may have.
Oh, I know of him, but I didn't know he was at St. John's.
Yes,
I associate him with Brainerd, I guess.
That's right. He taught at Brainerd, the community college. And he taught it at Park Rapids, you know, and the setting of Staggerford, his first novel, is Park Rapids and Ponsford and the Pine Point School.
Yes.
What's the other one? Knights? Simon's Night, the second novel, and he's just got a new one out that I haven't seen, but he's done several more novels. He's he teaches creative writing at St. John's too, but unlike Powers, he started teaching very early, and teaching seems the most natural thing in the world for him. He's highly popular with the students down there, I know. And gets along very easily. That's no problem for him, and he's able to write, too. I know that Powers has a good deal of respect for him. He says he's a real professional. So they I don't know how much they see of each other, but they're on good terms. So I think if I don't dare ask Powers about his novel, I'll see if John Hassler knows anything about it. I'm busting the know.
You may know. Hassler was a recipient of one of the State Arts Board writing fellowships 2 or 3 years ago and made a wonderful appearance before our board.
Yeah, he makes a great...
Acknowledging and talking in such an informal and comfortable way about his need for privacy and desire for a certain degree of isolation and his satisfaction with living in small town Minnesota, and no wish to really go anyplace else.
That's right. But he seems easy. He's very genial and easygoing. I know in order to write at all, he has to. He has to find this kind of isolation.
Right.
But I think he finds it a lot easier to adjust to the world than Jim Powers. Powers is a very genial, very funny man, but a very private person.
Mm-hmm.
And, I hesitated ever to intrude on his life, but I had occasion to one time because I wrote a critical piece about him and I sent it to him to have him look at, and that started things, so
yes.
I got acquainted with him that way. And he is, he's a marvelous person, but I worry about him, and we can get started again. Well, we haven't talked about the North Dakota writer that, I suppose we should give some attention to people like Lois Hudson.
Yes, indeed.
Who's been living out in...
I think California, or Oregon.
Or Washington. For a while she lived, she was teaching at the University of Washington.
I see.
And living in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And she has published some things out there on Western subjects. I've seen some of the things.
I see.
But her Bones of Plenty, it was 1962?
I don't know the date.
Little Brown, I think it was. And she had another volume sort of collection, a short thing. That's pretty good. Pretty good. You know, she taught at NDSU for a while, about 20 years ago.
And again, this is a treatment of her growing up, the prairie experience in
around Jamestown,
in North Dakota.
Her milieu. Yeah. There's a writer who is not from this area, though I think he came originally from St. Paul, called Holger. And he published a thing called Shadow of My Hand. Again, a big panoramic saga type novel, like a Big Rock Candy Mountain. Cahill, Holger Cahill.
Oh.
Strangely enough, when I checked up on who he was a curator of an art museum in New Jersey or New York, or I think to me Newark or someplace like that. And how he set out to write this big, sprawling panoramic novel about the Shadow of My Hand, which is published by one of the big publishers, like Knopf or Harper's, I forget which one. And I've skimmed it, but that kind of thing doesn't... years ago, I used to be able to read that, but I don't seem to have any patience for it anymore. And if it were seen impressive enough, I suppose I would, but somehow or other, it doesn't seem to come off. But well, Larry Wodey is the one I wanted to talk about,
I
of course.
Because thought you would like to.
Yeah, he is
about him.
A very exciting writer. You can remember about nearly 20 years ago now, and we used to find, many of us would read The New Yorker, and we saw a name signed at the end of a thing called L. Wywody. The name seemed strange, you know, L. Wywody.
Yes.
And we were attracted, if we looked into the story, as many of us dip into these stories, we find some people reading the Fargo Forum, things of that sort. We picked up, we read these
surprising local references.
We couldn't figure this out. Who was this guy? And then finally, I think Doris Eastman or someone did an investigation and found out who he was, that he came. His family had come from, Matador? And that's just west of Wahpeton, always? Matador, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes in his books Muhammad, I think. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And that he ended up living in a town just west of Carrington, Sykeston.
Mm-hmm.
Sykeston, North Dakota. And that becomes Hyatt in his books.
In his books.
Well,
his father was the school principal there.
School principal in Hyatt, yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And that the family had then, when Larry Wywody was about 8 or 9 years old, and just after World War II, they went down to Illinois because his grandparents had moved down there. And I think the grandfather was a sort of small contractor, and he persuaded Larry's Woody's father to come down and join with him in this building. And there was some promise that he'd have a school down there if he wanted it. So Larry Wywody and his family really left North Dakota when he was only 8 or 9 years old, but his mother died a year or two after they got down there, and he connected it, I think, with the uprooting and the moving down. And I've always had the feeling that I remember in that Auden poem about Yeats, he said, "Mad Ireland hurt you into poetry," or something like that. Well, I just had the feeling that the death of his mother made such a tremendous impact on Larry Wywody that it just made a writer of him. You remember these claims that you can't really become a writer unless you suffer, or something like that, sort of that kind of thing. Well,
he would seem to bear that out.
I think so. I have this powerful feeling that in Wywody's case, when he refers to his mother and things, you remember that that story about the boy who does a performance and wins the prize?
It's a chapter in Beyond the Bedroom Wall, but it may have appeared in the New Yorker,
it did,
too.
And under a little different title.
Mm-hmm. I do remember. She coaches him to perform in a contest.
And at the very last thing, and he said, "And she was my sharpest critic and my chief rival," or there's something about it. There are several, that's one place, and there are several other instances in which the relationship between this boy and his mother was so intense, and especially that aspect, the creative aspect of his life, the artistic aspect of his life, is so much bound up with the memory of his mother that I can't escape from the feeling that that was the crucial element in making him a writer.
Well, that book, Beyond the Bedroom Wall, is highly autobiographical, no question about it. And it does deal very centrally with his relationship with his mother. And a description, the early part of his mother's life I can't remember whether she was a young teacher, but her early years of marriage and her isolation in a small town. And it's so vividly done. It grabs you emotionally.
John Hovey said he attended Valley City Teachers College with both parents, Larry's parents. That must have been in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. And the father died just about 4 years ago, remember?
Yes, I remember hearing that.
Just about the time that Larry came back to that reading. Well, even after his mother's death, he apparently came back to North Dakota and Minnesota. His maternal grandparents left North Dakota and settled at Osage, up near Park Rapids.
Yes.
And he spent summers there for a number of years with his maternal grandparents, and may have spent more time than that. And our other relatives back here, because he kept coming back to North Dakota, and he says that North Dakota, and to some extent this part of the country too, in Minnesota, had always had a special place in his life, kind of separate kind of existence. That third novel of his, what's the thing called, Papa John, which is set in New York.
I think that's right.
New York City, and a story about an actor in a soap opera thing who is kind of typecast as this elderly Papa John, and the upshot of the thing is that when they decide that they're going to change the serial and going to eliminate that character and have him die, that this actor, who'd been a lifelong actor, couldn't get a job anymore because he was, everybody said, "Oh, you're Papa John, you're dead." And it's a sort of a tour de force thing. When I didn't care and like it as much as other things, but when I talked to Waiwode about it, he's quite defensive about things.
Is he?
He says it's the most. He says it's the most compact of my novels. It's the most tightly knit, which is true. Beyond the Bedroom Wall is not.
Oh, well, it sprawls endlessly.
Nah, yeah.
Right.
And the subtitle was Family Album, which it is.
Yes.
And they are uneven, but you find different people like different things. Remember that one of the last things he wrote, at least it appeared in the New Yorker, a good deal later than some of these earlier stories, was the one about his great-grandfather, I think, pioneering at Matador. We call it Muhammad.
Oh,
And that is based very much on his family. The Waiwodes did come to Matador about 1880, 1881, 82. And many people find that extremely poignant.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful. The occasion is, you remember that he goes that the grandfather, that is, we'll assume now this is strictly autobiographical,
yes.
Which of course it
yes.
is not, that his grandfather goes back to bury his father.
I remember that as an early chapter.
Yeah, right.
And it creates the coffin and dresses the remains.
And
it's powerful.
Yes.
Powerful. Writing description.
Well, and of course, you know, we read that first Waiwode novel, What I'm Going to Do, I think, which was compared to which won, I think, the Faulkner Award in 1969.
That would be about the right.
Yeah, 1969, I think. And then setting in northern Michigan was compared to the early Hemingway stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, I thought a splendid novel. It really grabbed us.
Mm-hmm. That's a tale of a young marriage.
There were a couple of pieces from that that appeared in the Straits of Mackinac, one member, had appeared in the New Yorker also.
Mm-hmm.
But he was already at work on the Beyond the Bedroom Wall stuff before that, but then he interrupted and found a thing that he could carry through. And I still think, I don't know... I looked at it a couple of years ago, and I thought it seemed a little dated. It was very evocative of the young people in the late 60s, you know.
Yes.
And that mood of the times, it very, very strong.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how, if we were to read it now, we would read it in the same spirit or in the same mood.
I haven't read it since then. I
just looked at it, and I'm just kind of... kind of wonder, but I, you know that Larry Waiwode is teaching at the University of New York at Binghamton.
No,
he's writer in residence there. John Gardner, the novelist and critic, had been there for a number of years and had a very powerful following, and then was killed in a motorcycle accident right in the summer, two summers ago, and they got. Waiwode to come and take his place. Now this would be the second year. He and his wife had left New York and had come back west. We're living in Mott, North Dakota, you know, on a farm.
Mm-hmm. That was the last, I think, that I had heard.
Yeah. That happened about 5 years ago. Now, Tom McGrath, his poet, was a friend of Waiwode's. Mm-hmm. Waiwode, coming through this area, generally stopped in to see McGrath, because McGrath has left now, he's living down in the city with his brother. Not in very good health, but he would report on Waiwode out there. And it wouldn't support him. I think he had to support the farm in a way, but I think it's just he had to get away from New York, which is... He went through He went through some bad times. He had a problem, mm-hmm. I think.
Was he living in New York City when he wrote Papa John?
No,
that's the setting.
No, he was living out.
He was living here
at Mott then. Yeah, he wrote that in Mott. Mm-hmm. But he was living in New York City when he wrote Beyond the Bedroom Wall.
Yeah, he was.
Those things.
Mm-hmm.
And but they had some family problems. But they have got back together. I met his wife, and she seems to me a very strong person.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that, who was the Forum reporter a few years, Sylvia Payne, went out to interview him out at Mott.
Yes, I remember that.
And she was
that.
Much impressed by Woody's wife. They now have three or four children.
Mm-hmm.
The eldest girl must be about 15 or 16 mm-hmm. by this time, and there's a boy about 9 or 10, and it's at least one more.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard how he's getting along at as writer in residence at Bingham. Mm-hmm. Bingham, you know, as Harper called it, of the New York, part of that big sprawling City College New
yes.
York system.
Yes.
And it's the one that's the most emphasis on the liberal arts and so on.
Well, I remember that we went up to Grand Forks several years
yeah,
ago when Why Woody was participating in the North Dakota Writers
mm-hmm.
Conference. And he read, I think, the opening page from Beyond the Bedroom Wall. And he was terribly constrained. I believe his father had just died.
That's right. That's
and,
it.
But it was still a moving experience hear the writer read his own words that were the opening of that novel is very strong.
It is strong. Well, you know, he considered himself a poet. Some of his friends, I don't know, I'm not so sure that he mm-hmm. really, but there is it's highly poetic prose, as you
yes.
know, in
oh.
his writing.
And
he often, the last I heard was, I don't know whether he said this, or I just read this, that he was working on a novel that, or a sort of continuation of Beyond the Bedroom Wall, which
mm-hmm.
of course is what I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I hope he has more of that aim.
He's quite a young man. We have years ahead of us here.
Oh, yeah.
Lots to expect
right.
from him.
And he does seem to have gotten his life straightened around. I was worried for some time. I just didn't think he'd be able to hold together so
mm-hmm.
tightly
mm-hmm.
strung that I. But he seems to have, and his family situation would bolster them. I'm pretty hopeful
Good.
That he has more of these, that he has more North Dakota memories that can be spun, because that's a special type of thing that's most meaningful to us. And,
well, some great writers seem to have an absolutely total recall
mm-hmm.
of early experience. That's been true of
right.
many famous writers.
Right.
And it's
well,
an interesting phenomenon that they deal so well with that.
He's tried to explain several times that this the North Dakota experience of his had a special quality than any other experience he had in his life. And it seems so to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it comes through that mm-hmm. way in his fiction. It's of a different kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've spoken about novelists quite a lot. You mentioned Tom McGrath,
mm-hmm.
who is a poet who was in residence at Morehead State mm-hmm. for a number of years. And he has achieved a national reputation, too.
Yes.
In publishing, but you say he's now living in, he's retired, I
yeah,
think, from Morehead State.
Yeah, he retired about
Twin
a
Cities.
Year or a little more ago.
Mm-hmm.
And his health was not not very good. He has a brother living in Old Maple Plain or someplace like that, one of those Montauk areas outside
mm-hmm.
the cities.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that he is down there with his brother and his family. He and his brother, when they were younger at least, were very close.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I think, the other thing, he's estranged from his wife, but his son, Tomasito, had lived with him about every other year for a while, and Tomasito was a very strong factor in
In his life.
Life, yeah. Mm-hmm. He would now be about 13, 14, mm-hmm. 15. But I don't think he's likely to be back here very much because mm-hmm. I think of health reasons.
Sure.
Well, yes, there have been since World War II, of course, a good many poets come out of our area. Some of them have moved in, like Mary Pryor, but others, well, I suppose you could say Mark Vince. So he was born on Rugby, North Dakota,
mm-hmm.
left there at the age of one, but grew up in other parts of the country, in Kansas City and New Mexico, and has been back here now for 15 years. And then homegrown products like Mike Moose and others.
Mm-hmm.
We have quite a few poets, Richard Lyons over at mm-hmm. NDSU.
Who again very often reflect a relationship with the place.
Yeah,
I think you can
strong.
Describe them as regional mm-hmm. poets.
Very strong.
Mm-hmm.
Sense of place. You remember mm-hmm. that symposium we did on trying to
That was
to
the
analyze,
title of it,
yeah.
yes.
We try to analyze that sense of place.
Right.
Well, for me, of course, it is important, this sense of place. Not that I'm arguing for regionalism, but unless a region can produce writers who can look at the place and its people and its way of life and write about it, it seems to me something is lacking. And if you can do that, you add some... can you imagine the South without William Faulkner, mm-hmm. for instance, or mm-hmm. Truman Capote, or mm-hmm. Eudora Welty, or Carson McCullers, or Flannery O'Connor? Or, you know.
Right. Well, the South has really, you know, made a place in the annals of
right.
American literature because of a sense of place. And of the people who live in that place
right.
and their relationship.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting to note that the people who have achieved some recognition
mm.
and acclaim reflect that same kind of experience.
Yeah, it with each of those writers that we've been talking about, it'd be impossible to think of them without the South. Of course, Truman mm-hmm. Capote was gone for a long road, but other things, mm-hmm. the rest of them, their writing is all tied up with the South.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's been speculation as to why it is that the South produced great writers like that, and why haven't the others? I suppose 100 years ago New England did, or 150 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I suppose even since. You can't think of Robert Frost except in connection with New England. But I wondered about the Middle West, and there, of course, there is detractors who would say, well, can't expect Podunk to produce poets in the Middle West. Surely not. But I, from a more reasonable point of view, it struck me that the Middle West, that the whole current of American civilization or the civilization of the last 100 years has rolled over the Middle West. We've never been a backwater. You know, everything that has happened has come flooding over us, and we've been so much a part of the mainstream, I suppose, mm-hmm. that maybe we've too much getting and spending. We have laid waste our powers.
Well, I think probably society has become more homogenized through exposure to mass media.
Right.
And today, instant travel. With mm-hmm. all the travel bargains we're faced with, we travel out of here a great deal. Yeah. And that other people, of course, do too. But I think that's mm-hmm. a big factor in today's society.
Yeah, right.
Young people growing up today have a less separate,
less
distinct experience from other people.
Well, that's what Americans as a whole are accused of having little sense of place. The British, for instance, mm-hmm. you know. Look on us, they say, well, Grandpa is buried in San Diego or someplace like that. You know,
mm-hmm.
the Americans just are rootless.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's true at all. It can't be true. And it is with some people, I suppose, I don't have any, but I think people who write and are interested in writing do have a strong sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one of the most promising things that has happened in the last 30 years, and a lot of unpromising things. I think too much prosperity and too much material, too many material things. But I think also what maybe a byproduct of that, we have produced poets and writers and some good ones. Well, I suppose we ought to mention someone like Garrison Keillor.
Talking
about the Midwest.
Yes, we certainly should pay our respects to Garrison Keillor for wonderful, humorous illumination of the kind of people we are.
Yeah, I think maybe, possibly, he has done more than anyone else to make the Middle West seem a kind of place that's not contemptible.
has
a character of its own.
I sat next to a woman from Maine recently at a meeting in Hartford, Connecticut, and her one association with Minnesota mm-hmm. was Garrison Keillor. She and her family listen to the Prairie Home Companion and tape the episodes and replay them to their friends.
I've encountered that, too. He's made a very great impact, maybe as much of an impact, more of an impact, other parts of the country than he has mm-hmm. here. Because we are maybe almost too familiar with his stuff. But other parts of the country, he really has identified the Middle West as a distinct...
Yes. Well, he's another person who seems to have total recall early experience. But along with it, he has this marvelous power of invention.
Yeah.
He seems to be able to weave the story on endlessly and in a very entertaining way. Well... Before we wind up, let's go back to the sense of place that's reflected in your own writing and editing, because those mm-hmm. have been your particular interests. Mm-hmm. And could you comment a little bit on some of the work that you've done personally?
Well, yeah, I never thought of myself as a creative writer at all. I claim that I'm deficient in imagination. Maybe it's because I never tried. I don't know. I do have a sort of total sense of recall. I can do that. I just tried a couple of... In 1920, we left the farm. I was 8 years old, and we moved into a little town, Horace, on mm-hmm. here, 10 miles mm-hmm. from here. And I got to thinking, I wonder how much I remember about Horace in 1920, when I was 8 years old. And it made a very great impact. I can remember the ride in from the farm, the 4 miles in, in a grain wagon with our stuff. And I went down, there were 201 or 198 people in Horace that time. I went right down the street, and I could remember every single house and who lived in every single, all members of each family. And then, since I retired, and since I'm not a poet and I'm not a writer of fiction, the thing that has seemed most interesting to me is in working on regional history.
Mm-hmm.
And that I have found highly interesting. I think it needs, and we are a distinct region, the Red River Valley. Has some of the qualities, as you know, of the high plains and some of the farm country to the east and south of us. That is, we are not quite like southern Minnesota and Iowa, but we're not like western North Dakota and Montana either. We're sort of a halfway. We have some ingredients of both, and because the Red River does flow north, and because the first our contact with civilization came from the north through the fur traders and later on, long before there were any people in this area, it was a passageway for the people in the Fort Garry area. And there were some 5,000 of them before there were any down here. It was the easiest way for them to reach civilization, which meant the Mississippi River, Fort Snelling, St. Paul. And so the Red River carts began rolling through mm-hmm. here. A fantastic episode in our history, and then the steamboat era and when the railroads came, and then people started flooding in. Well, it's a distinct it's a story that seems to me it needs telling as truthfully as we can, because there is a certain amount of legend connected with it, some of it some base and some of it just foolishness, you know. But it's material, it seems to me, worth putting down in the best form. So that's essentially what I've been doing and will keep on doing. Right now I'm working on the history of this college, which is the oldest of the colleges in the exactly 100 years ago, it'll be February 24th, I know. Just 100 years ago, the state legislature passed a bill which appropriated $5,000 and designated that there would be a fourth normal school. There were three, Winona, mm-hmm. Mankato, and St. Cloud. There would be a fourth normal school founded in Minnesota, and it'll be at Moorhead. Now, Crookston was making a very strong bid for it, but Solomon Comstock got it from Moorhead. Mm-hmm. Solomon Comstock, that was at the height of his career then. 2-3 years later, he was nominated as a Republican candidate for Congress, elected to Congress. And he had a very strong following, very powerful influence.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1887, they passed a couple of more bills in which they appropriated enough money to build a building and to hire a faculty. So 87 is the year we're celebrating. By 87, mm-hmm. I've got to have a history of this place.
Well, it sounds like a monumental task.
Well, it is, but fortunately, the Moorhead Daily News, mm-hmm. Moorhead did have a daily paper.
Mm-hmm.
Going through those issues, the daily paper is some experience. It's fantastic, time-consuming, but you keep getting led astray because you're running a little bits mm-hmm. of information
yeah.
that you just sort of tantalize. But the amazing thing, what a totally different world you enter into when you read those issues of the Moorhead Daily News 100 years ago. This world is so far removed from our present world in all its assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
Or the early catalogs of Moorhead Normal School, one of the paragraphs says, the students of the Normal School are expected to go to the church of their choice, to attend the church of their choice, all such things. It's flat, no question about it. Nobody can question it.
Right.
You will go to church.
Well, that will make a subject for another interview, I think, is the, and I'm sure somebody will be contacting you about doing an interview for regional history. But I think this has been a really interesting overview of the scene in regional literature, and it creates a very proud record. I think we have a lot to point to much to delight in and to treasure in both quality and personalities here as writers. So on behalf of the Heritage Education Commission, I want to thank you very much for participating in the project.
It's been a pleasure. I'm sure I'll think about things that I should have said.
Well, we may have to do a sequel.
Right.
I'm sure other
right.
people are encountering the same problem, that we
yes.
think of all the wonderful ideas later. But thanks much, Zach.